Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com. Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Four inches of snow is like new for this time of year, right? Don't you get some early storms?
Oh yeah, we've gotten some spitting of snow last couple weeks. This is the first like real snow, which for deer and elk hunters, especially deer hunters, this snow is just money.
Yeah, I remember when I was on that mule deer hunt last year, everything was hot, and then as soon as it snowed, things got moving, and I was amazing at how many mule deer came from so many different areas. Like, they just came from anywhere. Yeah. I don't know where they came from, but all of a sudden, they were just everywhere. Nothing huge, but it was just crazy.
They're just hide-and-go-seek champions, and that's people don't give them the credit.
Yeah.
If they don't want to be found, they don't get found.
Not to be confused with Sasquatch, who is the current record holder. But, they're pretty good.
That's true. They're on four legs. Yeah. They're probably in top night category.
So I'll just do – I always have to press record. So I just recorded that. That's going to be the longest intro or the longest pre-intro. Got Jaden Bales back again. Always great to have you on, man. Thanks for being on here.
Yeah.
I just had...
Thanks for having me on, man. I like catching up.
I had Chad Riker on yesterday. I recorded one with him. And I think whenever I talk to you two guys, I have like one question or one thing that I want to make sure that I hit. But other than that, I'm just like, no, this is going to be... There's no need to have a whole bunch of questions because it's on.
Yeah. Well, that and that's what I think I've said before is like... as your Wyoming correspondent, I feel like we've got enough team chemistry here to just kind of cover some topics that I think you know might be valuable for other people and also catch up. So that's the fun part, right?
Yeah, for sure. So when you are talking about your snow, do you have like that? Is it the thin wispy stuff, and then later on, does it get a little more wet, or is it just kind of that thin, wispy stuff at all the time?
So right now it's coming down, and it was 28 degrees. So today, and it's supposed to warm up to the low 30s. It's going to be pretty wet. It's going to be kind of coastal style wet snow. But when you go up high, I mean, it's going to be dry and fluffy and powdery. So, this is the kind of stuff right now, like anytime you get into that 30 something degree weather where it's snowy and rainy, that is just like the boot tester's dream, because I swear that any day you're walking around in this stuff, you find a leak in your boot somehow.
Mm. Yeah. That was kind of where I was going with it, because you and I have talked about coming up here, and every time that you were talking about your boots, like in the muskegs and how they work. And every time I'm walking on a muskeg, I'm like, dude, you got to go rubber boots. You just have to go rubber boots. And then when I was down there a couple of weeks ago, walking around, and there was a little bit of sleet, a little bit of rain, and then walking through the grass, you eventually just, it just water works its way in, and then your feet are just wet for days and days, and like mine were, and it just did not get, and it smelled terrible, absolutely smelled terrible. By the third day of having wet shoes, then... Or soaked shoes. Well, no, I don't know if it's soaked. Wet shoes, a little less wet shoes than damp shoes. Every day for 3 days, it made my feet smell terrible. Horrible.
Oh. Yeah, it's terrible. And if you don't have a way, like if you're camping, you don't have like a stove or something to dry them out at night in the wall tent, like it's dang hard to get to ever get back to neutral. You're always fighting coming back from your cold feet.
So
that can get really gnarly on your feet too. Like it can really tear you up.
Oh yeah, yeah. Even with even wearing rubber boots up here, the either the Grundens or the Extra Toughs, you walk around for a couple of days in that, and your feet don't really get dry. They kind of get shriveled up, and it's not exactly trench foot, but it's not exactly good.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
So what do you use for like a cover or a coating or something to protect the leather or to keep things waterproof? That's the longest way that I have ever gotten to such a simple question.
Dude, Nickwax. Their Nickwax has a leather and suede kind of like wash on waterproofing. There's also just a bunch of different types of waterproofing stuff that Nickwax runs. This actually came from kind of back in the ski shop day, as we would, I worked at a ski shop in Eugene, Oregon, which is, you know, dang wet and everything. And you're trying to keep waterproof all the time. And the Nickwax, I think, was kind of the best all around stuff. Like the most reliable. I think that you could also oil your boots, you know, with, I know Kennetrek, for example, sells their own, oil compound that you rub into your boots. I think it works fine. But I do think that the synthetics probably last longer and do a better job. So unfortunately, like it would be nice if like all of the good oils, like were the best on the market, but I don't think they are personally.
Yeah. I went with, I go Snow Seal and it works pretty well. As well as certain things can. It just seems like,
yeah,
it's still going to happen. It's like,
yeah, that's good stuff too, though.
Yeah. So what is, how does your gear change, and how often are you out camping away from like a vehicle? When I was down there with Abby, every day that we camped, it was next to the car. And we just made long treks during the day, and we came back. There was one day that we had a fire in a ring at one of the fire camps, so it wasn't, illegal or anything like that. It was the day that she shot a grouse, and so we cooked up the grouse, which was pretty nice. But what are you taking back in there for those days where it's super cold in the morning, and then it's kind of not really hot during the day, but certainly nice and kind of warm as long as you're out of the wind. Like, do you take a whole bunch of different stuff, or is it just like, you know, you're going to be cold and you're just gearing for when it's going to warm up?
Dude, I like to think of it like, from the style of hunting that I do, first and foremost, right? Cause if you're out there chasing elk and you're running ridges all day long, you're going to have a different, you're going to have a different layering system than if you're going to go up to a glassing knob and sit there all day. So for me, I very much so it's a lot like the similar kit that I've always ran all fall, but, basically I just add an insulating layer. So let's just say, for craps and giggles, like, if you're running a synthetic, like thin layer as you're kind of a puffy in early September, then into October, I swap that out for like a down, like a lightweight down jacket. You know, like the Brooks down from First Light and like the Grumman down from Stone Glacier are like the two that kind of fit that mold. And then I always throw in like, I look at the weather, always look at the weather. I'm a weather fanatic. I don't know about you, man, but you probably just plan for shit weather every day.
Yeah, yeah, it's not even, I don't even know why I look at it. It's going to be rainy and windy.
Yeah. So I always like to like see if it's going to be, if it looks like, oh, clearly a storm system's coming through, then I'll throw in my rain jacket to put over the top of that. Like it's like a Gore-Tex 1.5 layer jacket from Outdoor Research. But then if it's not raining, then I always just have a soft shell to put over the top, something like a windbreaker that might keep off a little bit of like of a surprise rain or something. It also just keeps that down, keeps that down from getting ripped to crap when you're trying to change glassing spots or something. But anyway, yeah, I basically just go from a little bit like more synthetic, like thinner mid layer to a full on down puffy plus an outer layer.
Yeah.
I don't do anything with my pants. Do you?
I actually didn't bring a, rain pants down there, which is stupid. Well, actually, it's actually I tore up my rain pants to the point where I couldn't use them anymore, and so I was either going to bring down like my rubber bibs that I use for the rut up here. It's a thinner rubber, but it is definitely a rubber, and it's great because you don't have to worry about when you're sliding down part of the mountain or you're, you know, going through all the brush, like you're not going to tear it up. It's so nice. But not having rain pants was tough down there because when it started raining, then I got these pants. I have the De Havilland Stone Glacier, so that it's not waterproof at all, but, you know, it doesn't exactly soak in real well. So I was not as prepared on that one. But the thing that was kind of, I brought my puffy pants. I never put them on. I had the puffy jacket. And a couple mornings, it was really stinking cold. And you get out of the tent and it's really cold. So I had the puffy jacket on and I hiked in that. And I'm always paranoid about that sweat layer because up here, once you get sweat and you get wet, like you start to, you know, you're on the hypothermia clock. Right. But down there, I found that it's so dry. If you unzip and kind of vent it out, like it's like the moisture gets sucked out too. So it's just kind of a different program that I'm not really used to. And I don't get to use the puffy a whole lot up here because it is so wet. And so if that thing gets wet, it's not. I have a Sitka one, which is nice. I bought it on sale. It came from somewhere. I don't know if it's like I checked the logo. You know, you can when you go down south, you can go to these areas that they sell Oakleys that are actually like oaky. Like it's a knockoff brand. I was like, is this really a knockoff brand? Because this is a pretty good deal on this Sitka jacket. It's like, is it really a tee? Is it like Scylla? Or like what is this? It seems awesome, but I don't get to wear it a whole lot because it is usually so wet whenever it's cold. So, it's just different because there's so many things that I thought I wanted to have because it was cold. And then, man, if we shoot an elk, I got not a bag full, but a couple extra pounds to have in my bag. And then we're packing this elk out, which never happened. But just an interesting being in such a cold but dry climate versus up here where it's a lot more damp and then figuring all that stuff out.
Yeah, totally, man. And the other thing of it is like, I don't think folks give themselves enough credit for how much body heat they put out when they hike, you know? Like, man, I have such a hard time putting anything on more than just like a base layer and maybe a soft shell outer or something like that when I start hiking in the morning, down to 30 degrees or 20 something degrees. Like, I also, you know, if it's chilly and I always say like, be bold, start cold. Cause by the time you're 100 yards up the road, you're going to be like, or up the trail, you're going to be like, God dang it. I got to shed layers now. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's the one thing that like, I think that layer management is the hardest thing to dial in. And oftentimes the best solution is to be comfortable at the start or to be uncomfortable at the start.
I like quarter zip fleece, things like that. It's so nice to be able to have that down. So as you are like hiking, you're getting that cold air in. And so like your chest can almost feel cold, but the rest of you is warm. And certainly your back with no circulation because you get to pack on, that's going to be sweating, but it's nice to be able to have that. But just, it's going to be levels of hopefully just discomfort rather than full on misery as you're doing that stuff. But
yeah, for sure.
Styles were something that Abby and I were talking a lot about, hunting styles, and we were thinking about, you know, when we were going...
not related to gear.
Oh no, you're no, talking not about. I got no style.
Okay. Well, we were already talking about, and then you and I were talking the other day. Like I shot an antelope in my blue jeans the other day, and that was that was a throwback. That was great. But that's why I thought I was like styles. I was like, yeah, you've got the blue jean guys. You got the sick guys.
that was pretty funny. But I was thinking back to I made a comment about if it was a 1980 brand of Levi's, like that was back in that sturdy denim. You know, I don't even know if I could wear some of those old jeans anymore because now there's so much of that synthetic and the spandex and stuff in those jeans that are a lot more comfortable than they used to be. I can't imagine the chafing and I can't imagine the just discomfort that would come with wearing the old true denim jeans. And if you look at those old timers who were riding horses with those things, because you kind of had to, right? You had to have a sturdy denim. Like the skin totally had to just be like bottom of foot type skin in certain areas, and it's, that's not me.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
No, it's definitely not it. And I actually dealt with this question when I was on the search and rescue team in Laramie when I was living down there. Because these old guys, like, we had a horse team that was part of SAR, and the old guys running the horses were like, well, I can't wear synthetics if I'm going to ride a horse because you just get the crap beat out of your legs. And I was like, wow, that's a really excellent point. I got nothing for you. Like, they just have to, you know, if you're working on those kinds of constraints, you just have to manage your moisture better and understand when you're in danger zone, right? When you've gotten wet and you need to like really be cognizant of what your temperatures are.
Yeah. I'm teaching Into Thin Air with my Adventure Lit class, and
just, oh, I love that book.
Looking at the difference in technology, even from 1996 to now, things have changed so much. If you look at the gear, it's that old, huge, puffy North Face type technology, and things have improved so much from there. But if you look at the first people who were going up Mount Everest, or at least trying it, the weight of it, or you know, reading Endurance, the Shackleton adventure down there in Antarctica, when they just had this. They were always wet, but it was just that wool that was able to still stay dry. But I can't even imagine the weight of that. Mm-hmm. And just,
yeah, totally.
Just the gear, it's changed so much.
In order to do the same things that we do today, I mean, I think the moral of the story is like people were just way tougher.
Yeah.
And didn't have the time constraints, you know, like if they had to go warm up and they had to build a fire, or like I'm thinking about hunting in particular. And they had to go dry out their stuff over a fire at camp instead of hunting that day, or whatever the case was. Like, that's just, they took the extra time.
Yeah.
We don't take the extra time, I don't think.
Yeah. In the back of my head, I'm dreading, and it happens all the time, but I'm just dreading the moment where water finds its way in and my socks are wet. And I'm thinking, gosh, I'm so soft. Oh, are your feet going to get wet? Or you're going to have wet socks? Poor guy. You know, just come on, man. Stop being so soft.
That's exactly right. Yep. And I will say though, like, if you have the option to not do, like, to take care of yourself, you should. If you have the option to be comfortable, you should be comfortable. But being uncomfortable shouldn't ruin your entire hunt.
Yeah, there's no reason to invite unnecessary discomfort just so you can tell other people. That's just stupid. But so different style here, style of hunts. When Abby and I were down there, she had read a lot of stuff about elk hunting, and we'd both talked to you, and you were giving us tips, and I'd taken the Corey Jacobson course and read all that good content, and then listened to a whole bunch of different podcasts and stuff, and people say so many different things, and you have to figure out what tactic to use at what point. You know, they can't tell you exactly what to do every time. There's no one secret recipe. It's the same thing with blacktail hunting up here. You don't know what you're going to have to use. And so you kind of have everything in the brain and you try to utilize something. But when you're not hearing stuff, do you just keep moving? Or we weren't hearing any bugles, but we knew that there were some elk around. So like, do you go somewhere else to try to find something that's bugling? And that was kind of the Corey Jacobson tactic, is he just keeps moving until he finds a bull that's bugling, and so that's the one he's most likely going to be able to make a move on, rather than the quiet ones and trying to sneak up on something that you think might be there. And you know, is that a waste of your time versus going high versus low versus it's impossible to really tell, but do you just kind of go with the gut? You're out there elk hunting and you're thinking, you know what, this is the time to glass, and nope, I'm gonna go over there.
I think the biggest thing, and I actually was just talking to Jess a lot about this, because there's undoubtedly a lot of styles that work. Like there's no way that you can say this is the only thing that you can do kill an elk as our example, right? Like, you know, I think it, you have to play into, you have to play all of the factors into the game. So if it's the early part of September, you don't know where any elk are at yet, and you haven't scouted, like, let's say, like Abby did, right? It's probably worth it to be on your feet, moving and calling and trying to get something worked up and covering miles, right? Towards the end of the year, you know, we were, me and some buddies were hunting in an area where we saw elk. We knew the elk were there. They were bugling. And, you know, we were basically like taking a slower approach, and we're like, okay, we're going to wait for the wind to get right. And then we're going to drift in there and just try to sneak into those elk. Because when we're calling at that later half of the year, it wasn't working as well. So it was a lot more like sitting, waiting for the wind, and then moving slowly into their bedding zone. And it worked to get us really dang close. So, you know, I think that, you kind of have to take into seasonality, and then also your personal strengths. Like if you've eaten too many Cheetos all year and are having a hard time hammering the mountains, like that's okay to change your game plan and sit a wallow, or try to, you know, slow play a calling sequence or something like that. The other thing is that, like if you're in a highly pressured area, kind of like Abby's zone, and you know where those deer are, you just have such good knowledge of place that you can like figure out where, I said deer just a second ago, but yep. Elk, and you know where those elk move through. I've got deer on the brain right now. Then change your tactic and go sit on that meadow where you know that they roll through every evening, right? Like I think a lot of people get romantic about how they want to have it done instead of looking at like kind of practicality of how you would successfully fill the freezer.
Yeah, that was the thing. Day one, we were at the spot where she'd put up the game cameras and she'd had that experience. She'd heard bugling elk, and then she had called, and she actually got her Kindle out and was reading previously. And then as she was moving, that's when that 6-point was on its way over to her, but it hadn't made any noise except for raking a little bit. And so she was kind of caught as she was moving a little bit. And so I'm thinking we're just going to have experiences here, but we went in and we did some soft cow calls, did some bugling, you know, tried everything, but just didn't get any responses. And so then we're like, well, they're probably quiet now, so let's play the they're here, but they're going to come in quietly. And we sat, and it was just crazy. Nothing was happening for those first 2 days. And then we were like, all right, let's get out of here. Let's go put on some miles. And then we tried that tactic where just like miles and glassing, got up high. And, it seemed like we employed three or four different things. And at some point it wasn't really frustrating. It was just, this is kind of what you have to do. You got to figure some things out. And the worst thing we can do right now is panic or have that regret of, man, I should have come down 10 days earlier, or Abby should have just kept hunting by herself because she was having these great experiences and she should have just filled the tag. And so we could have, I know, like camped in glass for mule deer or something like that. But, it can be kind of a, I guess it would have been different if I had the tag, if I would have paid $1,000 for this tag, and this is all turning out a little bit differently, it would have been a little bit more stressful. But I think like keeping that calm, was good, because then when the season ended, it was kind of disappointing. I would have loved to call in an elk for Abby, and we had a couple of close encounters, but it just didn't really work out so hard with the bow. But then opening day mule deer shoot an awesome one with a rifle. So, it's just kind of recapping, and it is so similar. You know, I'm always curious about universal hunting tactics, and it's very similar to blacktail. There's times where you just, you're like, you know, I'm not feeling this, or the wind is different, or something's happening, or I'm going to an area where people are calling a lot, and they've been calling for the last month and a half. So are does going to be call shy now? Are, you know, all the stupid bucks or the curious bucks going to get, or the early rutting bucks, are they going to get taken out of the equation in early October before the rut is really on? They're just kind of curious, and you just kind of have some confidence, make a decision, and live with it, because you can't do two things at once.
That's exactly right. And I think you hit the nail on the head. It's like having some confidence in the game plan you're running. The other day we were, you know, we were helping a friend try to shoot her first elk. She had a cow tag, and we had glassed up some elk and knew the meadow they were using. And so like, we just went down there and sat at the edge of the meadow, and some of the other parties, like, or some of the other people in our party were just losing their mind. They just wanted to be walking the whole time. They just wanted to keep walking. And I think that if you take the, if you're like looking at a situation, you're like, wow, I think, you know, I'm confident this process will work. Then just run that process over and over and over again, you know, with like stick with it until something changes. And then like the other day, Jess and I were out hunting elk, and they're not bugling up here anymore. It's middle October, and they're still kind of in there. I'm sure you could find a bugle if you tried real hard, but they're not going to call in or anything. And it's rifle season. So we're sitting up here glassing. We glassed these elk. That herd of elk that we had kind of expected to come out 1,000 yards below us was more like 2,000 yards away with about 30 minutes of daylight left. So we're like, probably not going to get on them tonight. You'd literally have to sprint. You'd have to Usain Bolt your way over there and then try to get a shot before dark. So let's just still hunt. So we took, you know, the opportunity to kind of move slowly through some parks in the timber. And I love that tactic. It's actually what my dad likes to do. And I hated it as a kid. I just absolutely hated it. But we knew that there had been elk in this area, and we were like pretty confident, you know, we're like, all right, let's just move slow. And we're talking, you know, cover a few steps, look, glass, and then cover a few steps, look, glass. We didn't see any elk, but sure enough, we got to 80 yards on a bedded mule deer buck that Jess spotted, you know. And that's how you, like, when you're doing something like that, you find a critter like sitting there, and you're able to sneak up on it without them knowing you're there. It's just like, wow, that was going to work. You know, the elk didn't get here, but if you did that same tactic over and over again, that same style of hunting over and over again, you'd run into one and you'd get your critter down.
Yeah. I was wondering a lot about luck too. When we were over, we went across this little like valley to this other ridge, and we were looking down the ridge and had made a couple calls down in there, and then we just kind of sat, took a nap, and then we're working our way down to the bottom of it, then we're gonna go like head into the wind and work the edge of it, and it looked like an awesome spot, but it looked like a spot where maybe they had been at one point, and that was kind of the case. But we were walking past this bush, and then all of a sudden a grouse just flushes, just takes off, and we're like, man, that thing, like, it ruined it for his buddies, because once that took off, Abby ended up shooting one of its friends. And so I wonder if, like, in the bush, it was like, dude, just be cool. Be cool. Hey, don't do anything stupid. Be cool. Be cool. And then it takes off, and then it gets his friend shot. And I, like, we were so close to being past them. All they had to do is just be quiet. And Abby gets this grouse, not because it was, like, expertly hunted. It was because, you know, Steve took off and alerted us to the presence. So I just wonder the amount of times that we are successful, and it gives us confidence, but we may or may not have done the right thing. We were just lucky to some degree, but happened to be in the right spot to put ourselves in a position to be lucky. Is that that you watch Ted Lasso?
No,
it's a great show. The harder you work, the luckier you get, you know? And so because we were willing to do this, and we were walking, we're putting the miles in, you know, at some point you're going to have those encounters, and it's, and you do enough glassing, you kind of get, you can develop a feel. And I felt that a couple times when on that mule deer day, we're glassing one area, and I don't know why. I was just like, I don't feel it. And so we kind of went a little bit, we went a little westish, and then I just didn't feel it. I don't know why. There's a lot of stuff to look at, and I just didn't feel it. And then as we're going to the next spot is when we see a couple elk, and then we see the mule deer. And I was just like, how have I developed mule deer instinct? Was I just absolutely totally lucky? Because Abby wasn't really feeling where I was saying that we should go, you know, and it's just weird to develop those things, but you get that confidence that might not have happened correctly the next time. Like, you're just lucky enough, you get these feelings, and is it skill developing? Is it luck? Does it matter?
Dude, I think, like, obviously there's a level of skill or intuition that you build over time. But at the end of the day, like, the only the defining factor as to, like, whether or not you end up with the outcome you're looking for is if you're spending the time out there. Like, when I was a kid, my best friend's grandpa actually was just a elk killing fool with his bow. And he sat a tree stand like for elk and just would sit on this heavily traveled corridor. And, you know, we kept asking him like, well, we want to kill an elk like you. And yeah, yeah. And the only thing he was like, well, why aren't you sitting in the tree stand with me? Cause that's the only way that you can, you know, you can talk about tactics and you can talk about different ways to do it, but really like the only thing that's going to get you the outcome you're looking for is if you're in the woods and you're in the mountains and in the right place at the right time. So yeah, I think we put a lot of weight in. Look, this is coming from a guy who does a mule deer podcast every other week about the tactics of hunting mule deer. But I think that the time of field is what like makes a difference, like at the end of the day.
Yeah. It's funny too that I wrote that article for Rockslide and I included two scenarios about black-tailed deer hunting up here during the rut. And in both scenarios, I ignore one of the lessons that I had just written about. It's kind of knowing which one to employ or which one to focus the most on. Like, is it you need to be still, quiet, and patient? But sometimes you got to move, and just knowing which one to employ at a certain time it can be the source of a lot of frustration, but it's also that intuition. And like you said, you're just going to kind of get a feel, and sometimes maybe it works out, sometimes maybe it doesn't. But yeah, you just got to get out there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like, I think what you're kind of hitting on is like, once you do spend the time, then you start picking up the right timing as to which use different ideas, tactics, locations, you know?
Yeah. So as a podcaster, as someone who's ingested hours and hours and hours, weeks worth of hours of hunting content, what percentage of your knowledge and intuition has come from that? Are you saying, is it like a 90% being out there has taught me so much, and then 10% has been the online content, podcast, stuff like that? Is it a 50-50? Can you put a percentage on your overall mule deer elk knowledge and then attribute it to more actual experience, or is it stupid to try to put percentages to those?
Might be tough to put percentages to it because, you know, it's always the cart before the horse, right? The knowledge is important. Like, you got to have an idea of how to get there. But let's, as an example, I started really listening to hunting podcasts in 2015. It wasn't until 2020 that I probably would confidently say that I like started putting things together in any sort of predictable manner. So, you know, I think that makes the time of field is the defining factor, because you can have all the knowledge in the world, but if you don't actually do it, like, I don't know that it really matters that awful much. So yeah, I think it's probably on the front end, let's just say getting started, right? Like, you've never been hunting before, or you don't know what you're doing at all. You need the knowledge. You need like 80% of the knowledge, right? Like, is what's going to make the difference from the get-go, right? You can't just go out there with no idea what you're doing. But then as things change and as you develop as a hunter, let's say you start looking for bigger critters or whatever the case might be, your goals are going to change. Then that's, I think, where the time of field starts taking over, so that you could kind of hone in on what you're really trying to achieve.
Yeah, I like that. I
hope that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if, I mean, there's so many good metaphors that could work with that. It's kind of like the training wheels. And at some point, you got to be able to ride the bike yourself. And so, courses, podcasts, things like that. Then it becomes like an enjoyment. You can just listen to the podcast, listen to people talk about the stuff that they did. And it's a lot of fun. But
yeah. Well, it's one of those things where, like, you know, I've had friends and significant others be like, why are you listening to this podcast? Like, you've heard them talk about this stuff. Gazillion times over. Like, this is the same thing that you hear over and over and over again. I'm like, yeah, but one, it's enjoyable, like you're talking about, and two, maybe you do pick up some sort of like tip, or you rehear something that you hadn't thought of for a while, and then you implement that weekend, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's more valuable than anything, is just like the reminders, or like keeping your brain fresh, thinking about all the different scenarios and all the different situations you can put yourself in.
Yeah. If you don't know tip B, then you can't understand the nuance of tip B part one. That doesn't make any sense. Yeah. Like, I got to go to numbers. Tip number two, then you're not going to understand tip 2.1. So after listening to that more and more and more, you understand more stuff. Then when you hear this person talk, it's like, oh, there was a little nugget right there that I would have totally not even got because I wasn't even looking at the same book earlier on when I didn't know anything. But that stuff's good.
Totally.
And there's a lot of times where people don't really know what exactly to communicate as far as what the tips are. And there's also a difference between what you think you do and what you really do. I've noticed that a couple of times when I'm trying to tell Abby something, like, you know, when she was learning how to fly fish or something like that, oh, you do this. And I was like, wait a second. Like, I think I do that. Do I actually do that? And I was like, no, I actually don't do that at all. I think I do that. It's like a fundamental that I think I do, but I actually do something else. And that happens. You know, like, even coaching basketball, you know, like certain things, like you have to have your feet square and look at the hoop, but actually a lot of really good shooters have their feet tilted a little bit off to the side. But yeah, it's, I don't know. I was getting off topic.
That's one of my, there. No, it's one of my favorite parts about, being a new person into, or a new, student in a game, you know, like you're talking about basketball. I'm actually, I don't think I've fully committed, but I've got a trad bow now.
Oh boy.
At the house. Right. And so one of the things I'm really excited to do is just go, like, let's start from scratch. Right. And relearn and relearn and relearn. And it's the same thing when it comes to hunting different things. That's one of the things I think you do well as a podcaster. And then I try to do is just like, I try to start with a blank slate every conversation because, you're not going to learn if you think that you're tilted. If you're like, I shoot square to the hoop every time. And then someone points out something new fundamental to you, you know? And you don't think that you can improve upon your current stance.
Mm-hmm. Or you realize what you're doing is totally different than what you said.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
Yep. I like it.
Yeah. That's, It is fun to be like that sponge, and there's so much out there, and it makes me just think back to the old days when you only had, like, you know, Field and Stream would come out with an article, or Outdoor Life would come out with an article, and then you would hope it would be relevant to your region, and, you know, you could learn the tips or whatever from this story, and that was, or reading books, you know, there's so much content now, there's so much available right now, it's, a lot of it is super good, super relevant, some of it's hogwash, but I don't know. Like, it's ultimately just pointed to the fact that, like you said earlier, you just have to get out there and you got to do it yourself.
Yeah.
When you are making content, because you have, you know, you're, like you said, you do the Muley Monday podcast for Cody Rich, and then you've written some freelance articles. How do you approach presenting that content? Like, do you look at a specific audience? Because anytime you're writing journalistically, you have to have an audience and a purpose. Like, who am I writing to and what am I trying to say? Do you tend to pick out, like, okay, this is Jeff Lund. I'm running for Jeff, who doesn't know much at all about elk hunting or mule deer hunting. Are you like, okay, Jeff, this is what you need to know? Or how do you choose your audience and purpose for these articles you write?
Man, I will say, because of the way that I approach writing is, like, it's kind of something I do for fun. I write basically for an audience that looks like me, usually. Mm. And for people with kind of like close to my background. And like I said, I do it that way because it's most fun. So some articles that I have in the queue for this winter, I haven't started these yet, but like, one of them is, should you hunt in shorts? And I hunted in shorts back and pants back and forth for like the first 15 days of archery season or something. And so, like, it was just something I was curious about. And so I tried to answer the question. I think those kinds of things where you're trying to answer a question or try to like provide a solution to a query is fun because it gives you a direction to go right from the get. And then it also is like, kind of ultimately kind of helpful. I'm not a great story writer. And, you know, Jess actually has told me I need to do more story writing because it's something I haven't tapped into much, but that's partially like why I write the way I write is because I have fun with it. And I feel like, you know, if I have this question, maybe somebody else will too, and then we can answer it together.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Is that a thing, hunting in shorts?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I have some buddies back in Oregon, or I would say like acquaintances of mine back in Oregon who do it. But then in New Zealand and Australia, it's like pervasive across the country. So my buddy Hayden went to New Zealand for a year. He was kind of stuck there during coronavirus. Mm. And so he started hunting in shorts. And I was like, God dang it. I want to see if I can do that. So, yeah, here we are.
See, I would think I would like a very light pant. Because then you're not quite as exposed. You know, it's going to brush, things like that. And up here, the mosquitoes, like, there's no way. You want as much coverage as possible. But that's interesting. So, I mean,
I will say they're quieter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I bet. If you are going to pitch something like that, it's super unique. So, if that was your first idea for the first article you ever wanted to get published, would that be, would you recommend that to someone else who wants to write and hasn't been published to pitch a story like that? Because you want to stand out, but something like that, it's like, yeah, this might be a little bit too specific or not really. Would that be your first pitch?
I think it's important to understand, like, the publication too, right? Like, as an example, that is a great article for Rockslide, because there's a lot of stuff like how to's and like specifically about gear, and like it fits that audience and it fits that like communication style of Rockslide really well. Right. But that probably is not a good one to pitch to the Juno Empire. Right.
Yeah.
Is that so? I think it depends on like, I almost would work. And this is what I did personally, was I worked backwards. And I found like some places where I was like, man, it'd be great to contribute there. And I did a project that I thought was neat, which was I called it my 201 rifle build. And then I was like, I wonder, like, I did the thing already. And I was like, I wonder if I wrote about it, if they'd be interested in it. And so you kind of have to test. I tested the waters, with the publication first, mm-hmm. like specific publication and specific style. So I think that's, I don't know what your experience has been, but that seemed to be how I could get my foot in the door best. You know, if someone is more like Gray's Sporting Journal, who has, in my estimation, and I'm not an avid reader of Gray's, but in my estimation, Gray's seems to be a lot more storytelling and maybe a little bit more ethereal, like, and you like to write that way, or you want to write that way, then maybe you find out their style and pitch them something that would go well in their publication.
Yeah, there are two things that in there that I definitely incorporate into mine. One is like having a background knowledge of the publication, just trying to send stuff out to, like, Googling outdoor magazines and then sending a query. It's not very effective. So, like, knowing and understanding styles, what they're looking for, what they've had, what they don't have, and then also working like in advance, like Rockslide, you can get published quicker. Whereas a lot of these magazines are out. I sent an article to Alaska Magazine that's going to be published in this coming March, and they accepted it in the previous February. So you're like, you know, they're over a year out planning things to put in the publications. That is a long way out. But a lot of times, if it's mule deer season now, like, you're looking to submit something for a mule deer season next year, or like, right now it's almost too late to be submitting spring things. So, writing stuff that's going to be relevant, not only the content and the style, but also timing is important. And I almost never send queries. I like have the thing written. That way they know exactly what it is. And then if they want the whole thing, I can send that. But that's so important to match, and it's just going to up your odds, because it's difficult to get published. So anything you can do to increase your odds and show that you're a good writer, you thought it out, and this absolutely works with that publication. Being knowledgeable of that, about that stuff is so important going forward.
Dude, I'm curious how much you think that the personal relationships with these people is important. Because, I mean, it's something that I know has been crucial for me getting published in some things. Just being able to put a face to the name has been able to, like, fast track. It definitely feels like it fast tracks my foot in the door in some places.
I think it definitely helps if you're kind of, if you're known out there as a content maker, you're not some random person. But I think the problem that a lot of people run into is the fact that they don't have a connection. And that was, it was just kind of white noise. I submitted a couple articles to Meat Eater and they said no. And I was like, what the heck, man? Like I am in Alaska writing about Alaska stuff. Like, why would you not? But I don't, the amount of submissions that they got. And I was like, I can't be submitting stuff to Meat Eater. Like, it's just white noise. Like, there's no connection there. So that was, I don't think it was a waste of my time, but I was like, yeah, you know, that probably wasn't the way to go. At that point, they weren't as focused as Alaska stuff. It was a lot of news for more of the down south type stuff and wide audience stuff. So, it's difficult if your name isn't in there. So like anything that you can do to kind of get that first thing published and then deal with editors and talk with editors and be confident with that. And so I think, you know, a big magazine for your first one would be a really tough way to go at this point. So finding something smaller, even if it is just like a guest column or something like that for the local paper, you know, gets published that way. When you have your little bio in there, you can say that you've been published. And then, you know, you can kind of build that way. But, you know, that's the reason why, you know, you look at like the average listens of podcasts. What is it, like 100 downloads per episode within the 90 days? Like, that's not a lot. Isn't that the average?
And it's something low like that. And it's one of the reasons why, like, I really am happy to be working with Cody on his podcast, because I know it'd be so damn hard. And I kudos to you for building this podcast, because it's so damn hard these days to get something like that started off on your own. Man, the other thing that I would just comment on is the fact that, like, a lot, like you're saying, getting published in a local paper is really good. And maybe this is a pro tip, maybe folks can look into, but a lot of companies actually are hoping for more content for their website. So like Argali is one of the first places I technically like got published on, besides the websites I was running. And, you know, just because they're looking for really quality articles to share with their customers. Right. And they're probably not going to pay for it, but they will definitely like help take some of that information and can give you a platform to get started with anyway.
Yeah, that's definitely huge. And there's like Brad is so purposeful in everything that he does, which is an awesome business model. You know, you don't get the impression that he's trying to overextend or just grow, which is good. And so it's not like he's not exploiting anybody that wants to contribute and be published. It's just like, I'm not at the place right now where I can pay for it. And so if you want to be paid, then I'm not going to be able to take it. But there are some people who are looking for, you know, just how can I get as much free content as possible? And at some point as a writer or content maker, you have to figure out that you're putting time, effort into this thing. You should be compensated some way. It's not like a bratty entitled sort of thing. And maybe in order to get published right off the bat, you kind of, all right, I'm not really good yet, and so let's get just a couple things out there, and I'll do a couple things for free, and then now, all right, I'm at the point now where my words are worth $25, $100, $200, $500, whatever it is. So you kind of have to go through that, but at the same time, at some point, you gotta kind of stand up for yourself. The amount of free marketing that so many people get because of, you know, tagging people and whatnot, and Sitka's Diverge series is brilliant because they get so much free, beautiful photos to be able to share, you know, because everyone wants to win that contest, and you're getting so much advertising for Sitka, so many beautiful images. It's brilliant. But, you know, for so many of those people, they're so excited because Sitka shared their photo. they got so much more out of it than you did. Like, you get the proud. Like, it's good to feel proud, good to feel happy. But at the same time, like, man, if you're that good of a photographer, you know, you and an idea, like concept, like you can put those things together, then you should probably get paid at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's a tough balance to do for sure. Oh,
did you,
anyway,
do you have a difficult time asking? Like, did you ever have to ask like, hey, I'm expecting to get paid for this one? For like,
I'm in the middle of a handful of those right now, like three. So, I think that it's important. And let me just also preface by saying like, all three of these publications, I knew I was going to get paid. So it's good to have that conversation beforehand, but still I'm like, all right, guys, like this was published in July, digitally. And here we are in October, right? Like, all right. Like it's been a little bit, but, so I think that there is an element of like, you have to stand up for yourself after the fact as well. Okay. And I'm bad about it, man. I am as bad as anyone. I'm like, it'll be fine. Like, especially cause I don't do it for my day job. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Do you have any good tips for making sure that that's taken care of?
That's so frustrating. I had one point where I had written a bunch of articles and I was owed for, I think, 8 or 9 articles, and it was almost a year later, and I stopped writing for them. I was like, I'm not going to keep adding to this balance sheet until you pay me, because this is getting a little weird, right? This needs to, I feel like I'm being exploited. I appreciate the opportunity. I love the opportunity. I mean, the layout looks great. I'm so happy that you're using my articles in your magazine, but come on now. What's the deal here? And there was one that I sent in an article, and sometimes it can take between, you know, 4 to 6 months for them to even get back to you to say that they're going to use it or not. And so about 5 months afterwards, I said, hey, you know, did you get out of using this thing? And they're like, oh yeah, we put it in our reader submitted articles back in like June or something. So I'm like, wait, so you used it without asking or like without telling me. And then you put it in the reader's thing so that you wouldn't have to pay. I was like, that's pretty jacked up, you know? So that sort of stuff happens. Yeah. And I don't really know if there is much of a tip. You don't want to be a jerk about it. You want to give people the benefit of the doubt. Things get busy. They're running a business. They're trying to get stuff, you know, figured out for the next issue and whatnot. But, it can be difficult to be put in that situation where you're not, like you did the work. Like, you got it turned in. It was good. It was published. They benefited. So, you know, but you want to sound like, where's my money? You know, like a, I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. You don't want to sound ungrateful for the opportunity, but at the same time, wait a minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's good.
So what's next on the list there? I know Abby's kind of, she's not sad. She's moving up here, but she only went 1 out of 6 on her tags.
When is she moving?
No, she's coming up here on, she'll be up here next Monday.
When's she moving up there?
Monday.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, so she's going to miss her rifle elk season.
Yeah, she's going to miss. Well, we have a totally free, full freezer at this point between the caribou from, leftover caribou from the spring, the fish, mule deer we got, some elk, so 2 blacktails. Like, we're pretty good in. You know, we're pretty good on meat, but yeah, she wants to get up here and enjoy the duck season and things like that, and then hunt the rut up here. So,
So, did you? One thing I was actually curious about was, did that buck end up being a chronic wasting disease positive buck?
No, it was negative.
Negative.
Yeah.
So I sent my another really good friend of mine from Laramie into that same spot after the fact. And she shot a buck out of that. I assume it's the same herd of deer. So, and she shot a buck that was younger than yours or than your wife's. That was positive.
Really?
Yeah. So that's something that's kind of like got me. I'm really a major proponent of getting stuff tested, just because even if you eat it still, like I think it's a great idea to provide the data to the Game of Fish. And then another buddy of mine, he shot a buck and was the lucky, he got the lucky first chronic wasting disease positive deer in one of these units out in Wyoming. I was like, oh man, what are the chances, right? So that's something I've been watching, and Jess and I are going to go hunt hard for mule deer starting on Friday. October 15th is the opener around here, and we're just stoked. We've got a handful of deer spotted that are really nice, and we're going to also help her friend who is 17 get a deer, hopefully her first mule deer, and she can, because she's a youth, she can shoot any deer. So that should be super fun, you know, like having that kind of first deer experience will be a good, it'll be a good learning lesson. And maybe we could touch base after this whole deer season, and talk a little bit more about mentoring and stuff, because it's something that I am just firing on all cylinders about. It's so fun. But then after that, I got a Nevada deer hunt, and then I've got an Oregon elk hunt kind of back to back. So, I'm really excited for those. Those are my two trips this year. I haven't taken any big chunks of time to go hunting yet this fall. So nice. That's what's coming up for me.
Yeah. Speaking of mentoring, sometimes like I will reverse mentor. I'll be asking my students who know a lot more than me, like, hey man, when do you start calling? Like, are you, do you wait until, you know, November 1st? You call a little bit before. Yeah. I had a conversation with my students earlier this week about that. And we just kind of chat a little bit before the bell rang about, yeah, it just seems like certain areas people are already calling, you know, or, grunt or rattling, but not, rattle with forkies rather than 3 points, stuff like that. It's kind of funny to be in a spot where you can kind of share tips with the students who, I mean, they are out there and they're doing the thing and they're trying to figure stuff out. And it's pretty cool to learn from them. And I think a mentor has to be open to new things too. Otherwise it's just, I know everything and I will grace you with my presence and I will bestow my knowledge upon you because I am the ultimate hunter. Like that's no good. But.
Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. Anytime that's like maybe a good final parting thought is anytime you can learn from someone, don't miss the opportunity. Don't squander it.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. So give me the last little pitch for where people could find you, listen to your show, read your articles. How did that Wyoming Wildlife Foundation thing go? Is that still ongoing? Okay.
It is still ongoing. And if someone wants a Spoon and Crockpot, wants to join the Spoon and Crockpot Club, you can go get a t-shirt from us still. I'm not wearing mine today. I wore it yesterday, but the t-shirts turned out sweet and they're like limited run. We're only doing this run for the Wyoming Wildlife Federation, and it supports all of our boots on the ground work. So, that ends like the end of the month, end of October. So folks should check that out. That would
go to the website and get that, or you can go on the Instagram and do a swipe up thing or what?
We don't have enough people for swipe up, but, WyomingWildlife.org, and it's front center homepage, and you can go that way. Or you can go to our Instagram or Facebook and the links are pretty easy to find there. But, yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up because that is really important. And it's this whole time of year, like is where we get to have a lot of fun. And the rest of the year, we would get to work on making sure that we can have this fun, you know, as far as Wyoming Wildlife Federation is concerned. So, we've talked about the Rich Outdoors Mealy Monday podcast a lot. It's $5 a month to get Mealy Mondays and Wapiti Wednesdays and ad-free listening for the rest of the podcast that Cody does. I think it's a really good podcast feed. So if you want to give us basically the price of a beer a month, that's a good way to go do it. And then you can find me kind of at Jaden Bales on Instagram and anywhere else. There's the social medias. So thanks, Joe. All right. Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. All right. Call that good. Until next time, man. Take care.
Oh, it won't be long, I'm sure.
No, thanks, buddy.
Yeah. Talk to you later.
Later.
On Mondays, head offshore with Captain Scott Walker and Steve Roger for breathtaking deep sea adventures.
Coming to me.
Double. He's jumping.
Oh!
Look at that belly.
Don't miss Mondays with Into the Blue, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern.
Tell a few fish stories along the way.
On Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
Every once in a while, it's fun to go with like just full-blown redneck on these fish. This is like high-tech cane pole fishing right here.
From the white sandy beaches to the crystal blue waters, enjoy the best fishing Panama City Beach has to offer during Chasing the Sun. Sundays at 9:30 a.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.